Public impeachment hearings start this week on Capitol Hill.
It's a test for democracy, but at the same time, it's also a television show. And I think we have to view both as true at the same time. And so the challenge for the Democrats and the Republicans is what kind of show are they going to put on?
But with both political parties divided on the facts, we examine what messages will dictate the public narrative.
The American public deserves to have a pretty singular focus on what's happening in these hearings.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, November 11th, we'll talk about the media's role in covering this new chapter in the impeachment inquiry. No horse races allowed here. Also on the show, a new generation of children affected by the lead crisis in Flint are going to school, and they're facing a lot of challenges.
Our community failing us. Our school system failing us. The job system failing us. We have nothing.
Is the education system prepared to meet these students' needs? We start with impeachment. Let's get going.
The Trump impeachment inquiry goes public this week. A new, huge, critical, key, and unpredictable chapter of enormous consequence.
Impeachment is a very serious matter. The Founding Fathers said it was a very serious matter, and so it ought to be public.
You're going to impeach a president for asking for a favor that didn't happen and giving money and it wasn't withheld? I don't know what you would impeach him on.
The president broke the law. This is a very strong case of bribery.
Tell Mr. Trump, release your tax returns or be quiet. Be quiet. You're worried about corruption. Deal with it in your own house.
I will say I'm pretty sure how it's likely to end. If it were today, I don't think there's any question. It would not lead to a removal.
Those open hearings will be an opportunity for the American people to evaluate the witnesses for themselves, to make their own determinations about the credibility of the witnesses, but also to learn firsthand about the facts of the president's misconduct.
I've written the whole process off. I've written him off. I think this is a bunch of BS.
They seem to be incapable of forming a quid pro quo.
I'm sure it was fine. I mean, you know, I make a lot of calls. But I have no problem releasing it. I'm very transparent.
This week, a new phase in the impeachment inquiry begins. Starting on Wednesday, the nation will be able to watch impeachment hearings broadcast from Capitol Hill. William Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat to Ukraine, and George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs, will be the first to publicly testify about the alleged efforts of President Donald Trump to pressure the Ukrainian government into investigating Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Their testimonies, followed by former Ukrainian Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch on Friday, mark a turning point after weeks of closed-door hearings conducted by the House's Intelligence Committee. Defenders of President Trump have characterized the proceedings so far as little more than political theater.
This is Soviet-style rules.
But opponents say this is democracy in action.
I think it's a good idea to make the hearings public, and people will then have to make their decisions.
The public won't just be reading about it in the New York Times or tuning into ABC or CBS. They'll also be seeing it play out in real time on social media platforms like Twitter and splashed across chyrons and cable news channels.
A new, huge, critical, key, and unpredictable chapter.
As the public hearings take over the news cycle, journalists will need to take a long, hard look at how we're covering the proceedings and how we can do better. Margaret Sullivan is a media columnist at The Washington Post. Margaret, always great to have you here.
Thank you, Tanzina.
And also with us is Brian Stelter, the host of Reliable Sources and CNN's chief media correspondent. Brian, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Lots to talk about. We just heard all of the intrigue, if you will, Brian. We're hearing that these public hearings are the start of a new phase in the impeachment inquiry. How is the game going to be changed?
I think because this will now be televised live everywhere, radio, television, streaming, this will be impossible to ignore. Well, at least to the extent that anything is impossible to ignore in the digital age. This is the first internet impeachment. It's the first social media impeachment. It's the first impeachment since Fox News was a powerful force in the nation. And this is going to be the kind of event that gets remixed and distorted and clipped in all these different ways. But at its core, having these live hour-long hearings will, I think, start to bring a lot more clarity to what has been a kind of confusing story.
And Brian, the House is starting the hearings with two witnesses.
Right.
As we mentioned, Ambassador Taylor and Assistant Secretary Kent. What are the optics of these two officials testifying together?
Yeah.
Like, is that going to make it more difficult for journalists to cover?
somewhat more difficult, but I think it's important. I think what the Democrats are trying to do is show that there are many officials throughout government that were all alarmed by the president's conduct, all trying to speak out, all telling a consistent story. And although there's a lot of names to keep up with, a lot of testimony that's already come out, that's a lot to keep up with, the story is pretty consistent.
Margaret, you, in your latest column in the Washington Post, you outlined some recommendations for how journalists can best cover the hearings. It's been a contentious couple of years for news media in the political cycle. What mistakes would you like to see journalists avoid going forward?
Well, one of the things, Tanzina, that I think that we've been struggling with in the Trump era is the president, and before that, Trump as a candidate, his ability to distract and to sort of, I like to say, serve as the media's de facto assignment editor to say, well, actually look over here at this shiny object. And I think in this case, the American public deserves to have a pretty, you know, singular focus on what's happening in these hearings, not, you know, what might be happening in on the sidelines.
We hear a lot about phrases like quid pro quo, for example. Should journalists be using phrases like that in their reporting? Should they be talking about them as a euphemism? Should they include them at all outside of quotes?
So, I don't think that most people – I actually had 4 years of high school Latin, so I, you know, kind of know what it means literally. I don't think if you a couple of weeks ago, if you went around asking people what that meant, they wouldn't know. I think they do know what it means now, this for that, basically. There are people who think that, you know, the words bribery and extortion are more appropriate, and I think they've got a point.
What have journalists been doing right, Margaret, if anything?
Well – journalists have done a lot right in the past couple of years. They've dug up a lot of what's happened. They've broken through the difficulties of covering an administration that, although the president claims to be transparent, you know, there hasn't been a press briefing, a so-called daily press briefing in more than 6 months. And yet journalists who cover the White House and who cover issues surrounding the federal government have been able to pretty much tell American citizens what's going on. And I think there's great credit for them in that.
Brian, we talked about the language and quid pro quo, but let's talk a little bit about Trump and his allies. What's the message or the narrative that they are trying to deliver to the media so far?
Yeah, I think through sheer force of repetition, President Trump and his allies are trying to convince everyone that this entire scandal is about a single phone call. And the president calls it a perfect phone call. He's basically daring anyone, any of his supporters, not to believe it's a perfect phone call. By the way, as Jeffrey Toobin said on CNN yesterday, who goes around saying their own behavior is perfect? You know, who goes around saying their own phone calls are perfect? Some of this is ludicrous. But the president is trying to convince people that this is all about a single phone call, when in fact it's about a months-long effort to have a shadow foreign policy led by Rudy Giuliani, extort a foreign power for the president's reelection bid. Look, I think journalists have to keep bringing those facts back to the table and make sure we don't get too lost in the fog that the president wants to create. Look, he was tweeting more than 2 dozen times just on Monday. I'm sure he'll tweet 2 dozen times again today. He's actually been tweeting more and more and more every month. He's trying to yell more loudly as this scandal deepens. And we have to cut through that fog every day.
Who are we speaking to? Because there seem to be different camps here. And we know that there are folks who, you know, Trump's base and Trump's support, I should say, hasn't really wavered since he's taken office. It's hovered around 40%. Are those the folks that the president is trying to talk to, or is he trying to convince a broader public that he had nothing impeachable here?
Well, right? Margaret mentioned the lack of press briefings. That's a sign of weakness on the part of the White House, but it's also a sign that this White House is not trying to convince 100% of the American people. They're really only speaking to the base. There's a reason why the press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, only goes on Fox News and Sinclair, because she's only trying to reassure the president's supporters to stay with him. She's not trying to persuade anyone else to give him a chance or to think differently. Look, I think what we see in the polls is this incredibly high disapproval of the president, let me put it this way. We don't see a lot of people who are lukewarm about the president. They either strongly approve or they strongly disapprove. About 3 in 10 Americans strongly approve. About 5 in 10 Americans strongly disapprove. Will those numbers change? Perhaps not. But if only 10% shifts, if only 1 in 10 Americans shift, that can have profound consequences in this impeachment, because Republican senators, who ultimately are the ones that are going to decide whether the president stays or goes, they are watching those numbers very carefully.
And Margaret, to that point, I mean, who are journalists thinking about, or should they be thinking about, when they're reporting right now? Because as we said, the president's base has been pretty consistent. You know, it's a pretty polarized moment right now. You know, is there such a thing as a false equivalency in terms of reporting this impeachment right now?
So I think that we have to report the facts and do our best to communicate what's happening without really thinking too hard about whether, gee, are we going to get through to Trump's base or anything like that. It's not our job to think that way. I will say that, you know, I mean, as someone who's written a lot about Trump and the media, I hear a lot and have heard a lot from people who are strong President Trump defenders, and they're very angry at the news media. They're very angry at the mainstream media, or the, as I like to call it, the reality-based press. I don't think we can get bogged down in that. We've got to talk to people as if they were, and many, many people are, American citizens who are hungry for information, and, you know, let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I would say it's the challenge for Democratic politicians and for other politicians to convince people to change their minds, to try to win over Trump supporters. Leave that to the politicians. I think we in the press, though, have to recognize that we are existing in these alternative, in these competing universes of information. And that's what's going to make this impeachment process different from the Nixon or the Clinton years. Even in the Clinton impeachment, Fox News was a very small channel, very low-rated channel. And the internet was basically just a text medium, really not a social media medium at all. So we are now in these competing universes of information. And I think we have to be aware of that and cognizant of that, and know what is being said in the Fox News universe. But I agree with Margaret that, you know, our job is not to persuade, it's to inform.
And, you know, to that point, again, we're talking about Fox Media and Fox News. You know, we've seen this strategy by conservative media and the president in terms of undermining the credibility of certain witnesses. The latest example being Colonel Alexander Vindman during the closed door proceedings. Do you think, Margaret, we'll see more of that going forward in this impeachment inquiry?
Yes, this is absolutely, you know, Trump's methodology is to, you know, counterpunch, to disparage. I mean, he learned it at the knee of Roy Cohn. And, you know, it's always never admit wrongdoing and always go on the attack. So we will see that. And it's going to happen more and more. And that's, you know, we have to know that and sort of, you know, I think we can write about it. I think we can take it on. But again, as Brian says, it's not our role to persuade. It's our role to tell the story. So it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a very challenging time. I will say that despite all the attention on social media, and Brian's absolutely right about how we live in a different media sphere now, I do think that the televised aspect of seeing these witnesses or spokespeople who are credible and who have a strong background will be very persuasive for people. I think that the televised medium is a powerful one, even if it's cut up into pieces by social media and, you know, we see it in bits and pieces. It's still going to make a huge difference in terms of people hearing it and truly getting it for the first time.
Brian, how is CNN planning to tackle the televised hearings so far? I mean, what are we throwing everything at this?
Yeah, there's going to be even more hours of live coverage than usual. I think I'm booked for 1 a.m. on Thursday morning.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Certainly, you know, this is going to be a wall-to-wall on all the networks, including Fox News, by the way, lest anyone wonder if they're going to ignore all of this. We're going to see this on the broadcast networks, on cable, on radio, of course, as well. And, you know, in this internet age, we're going to see this on Twitter and Facebook, and we're going to see this remixed and condensed and clipped by both partisans and by journalists, by people trying to sum it all up. You know, because the reality is most people don't watch these things wall to wall the entire time. Even the Michael Cohen hearing or the James Comey testimony a couple of years ago, you know, about 20 million people tend to watch these things live in real time. But everybody else soaks it up like a sponge a little bit later. And I think what you ask yourself in that case is, what main messages are Democrats going to get across? You know, are they going to be talking about abuse of power? Are they going to be talking about fitness for office? for me, just as a citizen, this is fundamentally about truth and lies. Truth, whether the president's trustworthy, whether he's abusing his office. And I'm curious to see if the Democrats are able to put on a quote-unquote good show.
Well, let me put
because
to that point,
honestly,
though,
it is a television show as well as a test for democracy.
So let's talk about that, because there are some journalists who say, you know, don't cover this like a game show.
Right.
And Brian, you faced some of this over the weekend
on Twitter.
I did. Some people were like not happy with how you describe what was coming up. So how do you respond to that?
I think there's two levels of this that are both true. On one level, this is a really serious test for democracy. And obviously, I think the country's in a crisis mode because we have a president that is so deceptive. So that is true. It's a test for democracy. But at the same time, it's also a television show. And I think we have to view both as true at the same time. And so the challenge for the Democrats and the Republicans is what kind of show are they going to put on? Are they going to hook people in the first episode? You may hate that we live in this environment. That
people hate
is,
it. People
and some
hate
people
it.
Do. And sometimes I do as well. But you know, I think we have to recognize that the Congress is competing with Netflix when these hearings begin, competing with podcasts, competing with all of these other forms of media that are out there. And I think the Democrats know that, by the way. A House leadership aide said to CNN's Lauren Fox, we know the first hour has to be explosive. We know the first hour has to hook people.
That's what got you in trouble on Twitter, Brian.
But that's a House leadership aide being quoted out there.
All right.
But look, I get it. I mean, hopefully people will judge what happens at these hearings on the merits and not on the performance.
So, Margaret, to that point, I mean, there are so many different areas that this is going to be covered in, so many different ways to watch and read. I'll give you two examples. We heard even Rudy Giuliani is talking about starting his own impeachment podcast among the, 50 impeachment podcasts that are out there. How are those channels, if at all, likely to cloud the debate? Are there people who are going to be listening to that Giuliani podcast or the one podcast and ignoring the rest, or is it just going to be too much?
Well, we do tend to be in our echo chambers for sure, and to seek out, you know, the commentators, the news coverage that sort of supports what we already think. But I think there's going to be something at a higher or maybe a deeper level than that. One thing that I find really interesting, just as a sort of a window into how people are seeing things, is to watch the evening news on ABC, NBC, and CBS every night, and I kind of move around among them. Because that's a very tight half hour that's reaching more than 20 million people every night, and it'll be high now because people will be tuning in. How are they covering it? And then I think you see the distilled messages that are actually getting through, and it should be very interesting to watch.
There's also this little world of book publishing that gets a lot of attention. John Bolton reportedly has a $2 million book deal in the works. Authors weep when they hear that type of advance. and of course, there's Anonymous, who just has his, or their, I should say, high-level Trump administration official releasing this tell-all this month.
Right.
What's the impact of those narratives, Margaret?
Well, I mean, they do affect people. And, you know, we see these books, you know, fly to the top of the bestseller list often. I think they also are part of the echo chamber, that people who are, you know, buying Don Jr.'s book or, you know, whatever it may be, are to some extent have their minds made up. I think that these televised hearings and what comes out of them is going to be a little bit different, and to be able to get to people who are – and I do think there are people who are still – if not in the middle, people who are not completely convinced and would like more information.
Brian, to that point, and go ahead, respond.
I was thinking about one of the great things about the country that we live in is that you can choose not to care. You don't have to vote. You don't have to pay attention. You don't even have to listen to the news.
But do you have a choice, though? It's everywhere.
it feels like it is everywhere, but some people tune it out, and they have the ability to tune out and the right to tune it out. And in a moment like this, when there's been scandal headlines for 6 weeks and impeachment talks behind closed doors for 6 weeks, it's been pretty easy to actually tune it out if you want to, if you just want to watch Netflix and listen to podcasts and do the rest. It is different when there are televised hearings. It does make it harder to ignore. And I think that is why this moment does matter. Because, some people will still tune it out. Some people have made up their minds. But I agree with Margaret that there are some who aren't as dug in as we may think, or as the polling may even indicate. You know, people talk in a negative way about low information voters. I think that's oftentimes as a derogatory perception, but let's just call them casual, you know, voters, casual news consumers who don't care every second of every day about the news. when they look up at the television and they see these hearings, it may make a difference.
So you think, Brian, in about 30 seconds, you think people will be watching the actual hearings on television or the distilled version?
But enough. But enough will. And we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what surprises the Democrats may have in store. We don't know what surprises the Republicans might have in store. And we don't know how this is going to end. I think anybody who tries to tell you they know how this is going to end or whether the president's going to be in office in a year or whether he's going to be reelected, nobody knows. And that kind of American mystery, that does compel people.
And to Margaret's point, don't make predictions, right?
Don't make predictions.
We can't tell. Brian Stelter, host of Reliable Sources and CNN's chief media correspondent, and Margaret Sullivan, media columnist at The Washington Post, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is Elizabeth Abraham from St. Petersburg, Florida, and I am going to be watching the hearings, the impeachment hearings. I want to make sure that things seem fair and objective and that they're not just kind of one-sided. The whole country can see that we are following the Constitution and doing the best thing that we can.
This is Ron Little Rock. I will not be watching because I have a job. And the only thing this place is missing is a kangaroo to go with the court. There is no law broken. There's no reason for impeachment. It's a waste of time.
This is Jose Luis Moscovich from San Francisco, California. And I do intend to watch as much as possible of the impeachment proceedings. The main question I have is, can we impose jail time on government officials who refuse to cooperate with Congress? That, I think, would send a clear signal that there's no impunity to be gained from trying to game the process.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. This is The Takeaway.
Have you ever had an encounter with someone that left you feeling a little braver?
I remember getting in a car and just driving, and it was just for curiosity's sake. That freedom led to, like, a lot of rediscoveries. Just for life, things became colorful again.
Join me, Helga Davis, for conversations with artists and thinkers who share my passion for living fearlessly. It's a new season of Helga. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's been 5 years since the Flint water crisis was thrust into the national spotlight, and the city is still struggling to deal with the public health crisis. Children who were born prior to or during the crisis are now in school, but the number of young students who require special education for physical or mental health needs is greatly outpacing the resources available. And many people are blaming the contaminated water for the rising rate of special education students in the district. Here to tell us what the situation looks like today is Corey Mitchell, a staff writer at Education Week, and Bill Therrien, a special education professor at the University of Virginia. Corey, Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Corey, let's start with you. In your reporting, you show that 1 in 5 students in Flint's public schools is now eligible for special education. That's an increase from years prior. When did people start looking into this? Was this spawned by the Flint water crisis? What were some of the warning signs?
I think it was a lawsuit by the ACLU of Michigan, the Education Law Center, and some others starting to look at children affected by this and wondering what was going on, whether the district was able to support them. And that spawned all these questions about the lead and how it was affecting these young people.
And when we say that the children are eligible for special education, what does that mean exactly? How are our children being measured for that?
At this point, it's a lot of the district's assessment of needs, diagnosis of ADHD, of autism, and children could be blind and a number of other things have learning delays. So we're talking a wide range of things here, just not solely learning disabilities, but that is a big part as well.
Were people expecting this change to happen? Because we've heard about this story, as we said, for 5 years. So I'm wondering if local officials were prepared for an influx of children who might have been affected in some way by this crisis.
I'm sure that people were bracing, but there's no way that you can really prepare for what's happened there. I mean, the special education rate in the district was somewhere around 14%. pre-crisis. Now it's at least 20%, one in five kids. And when you take a school district that was already in distress and sort of add the loss of students that's come with the lead crisis, you're basically putting these children and their parents in a situation where the school district can do not nearly enough to meet their needs.
Bill, when we talk about the impact or the effect that lead has on the health of children in terms of both neurological and behavioral exposure, what are some of the signs?
Well, in a school environment, what we notice primarily is decreases in academic achievement. There's also pretty extensive evidence for a lower IQ, attention difficulties, difficulties with executive function, and then non-academic behavior. So we see things like impulsivity, aggression, inattention, conduct disorder. So there's pretty extensive evidence that show impacts of lead poisoning in school-based environments.
And does it matter or does the effect change depending on the age of the child?
So research shows that kids are most susceptible to lead poisoning between the ages of 2 and 7. But what's insidious about lead is oftentimes we don't see the effects until much later in life. So upper elementary school, middle school, and high school, where the cognitive demands are much higher. So we often don't see the effects from a school-based perspective until much later.
Corey, you talked a little bit about how the school district in Flint is already under a lot of pressure and because of the lack of resources. But we have to ask now, with one in five students being impacted by lead poisoning, whether or not the resources in the school are going to be enough. I mean, are they equipped to bring in professionals who are able to deal with the not just the physical manifestations of this poisoning, but also the behavioral manifestations?
To this point, they have not. We talk about that one in five number, but roughly one in four of the teachers that they have in classrooms with these students aren't certified to work with students with special needs. They're hiring long-term substitutes and contract workers to deal with these students who have very demanding needs. And plenty of the parents that I talk to in Flint are just concerned that just because you have someone in front of them doesn't mean that you're helping them.
Bill, when we talk about what if these students don't get the support that they need now, what are the consequences for learning and educational attainment as they get older?
There's going to be significant consequences. There's been a lot of research that shows there's higher dropout rates. Individuals aren't going to be attaining the social skills and the behavioral skills they need to be successful in vocational settings. And they're often not going to acquire those basic academic skills, those reading, writing, and mathematics skills they need to be successful in life.
I want to ask both of you your thoughts on the fact that this isn't unique to Flint. We've seen elevated levels of lead in water, and even a colleague of ours here at WNYC did a big expose on lead paint in schools here in New York City. So we're seeing that in Newark, in Pittsburgh, in New York City. Are you concerned about the effect that this will have nationally on a generation of children right now? Bill, your thoughts?
Yes, I'm very worried about it. You make a perfect and wonderful and unfortunate point that this is going to be a concern throughout the nation. And we really need to make a concerted effort, not only in Flint, but in these other communities, because there's thousands of communities that are dealing with lead, whether it's lead in the soil or lead in the paint or lead in the water. And it's going to impact children and their education for sure.
Corey, your thoughts as an education reporter when you see this playing out in cities across the country?
We should be very concerned. We think that, we can blame, some of these issues on a home environment or poor parenting when many of these students may be suffering from lead poisoning and in classrooms or in situations where people don't understand what's causing them to act out in class, what's causing these behavior issues, what's, causing these learning delays or executive functioning issues when it's a very insidious and thing that's sort of hiding in plain sight.
Bill Therrien is a special education professor at the University of Virginia, and Corey Mitchell is a staff writer at Education Week. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're now joined by two parents with children in Flint's school system, Brittany Thomas and Melissa Mays. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Melissa, we'll start with you. What was your child experiencing in the past few years?
Well, my kids were doing great. They had actually, my oldest had tested into a dual enrollment high school to where he was taking college classes and high school classes at the same time. So he was working very hard, doing well. And then the water crisis hit and he started having problems with his memory, concentration, focus. And by the time he hit his junior year of high school, he was almost ready to fail. But the fact that my kids, we decided to move them from Flint schools because of the issues to a smaller school just outside the district, it was small enough to where they caught this and he got a tutor. Same thing with my youngest. He started having speech problems, started losing some of his words, and the school caught it. So we were lucky. However, the families I work with on my caseload, their kids go to Flint schools, and right now their kids are having the same struggles as my children. They have memory loss. They have trouble handling their anger, making decisions, focusing. Their executive functioning is slower, so they're having a harder time processing information. But yet in Flint schools, no one's doing IEPs. No one's assessing these kids to see that what their needs are. They're just ignoring it and pushing these kids through or kicking them out.
Brittany, tell me about what your children or child has experienced over the past few years.
My daughter, she was just normal until one day she just all of a sudden fell out and just started having seizures out the blue. Like, she never had no seizure or anything up until just 2 years ago. And like Melissa also said about her child, like the memory loss, they're losing their memory. She's failing in school. They don't want to do no IEPs for her. And like my son as well. I've been dealing with him since 1.5 with seizures, and it's just getting worse. It's not getting no better for neither one of them.
And Brittany, you've had to take time off to deal with this, right, from work?
No, I didn't take time off. I actually lost my job. I didn't lost like 4 or 5 jobs within the last couple months with my daughter by her being admitted in the hospital, or she got to miss school, or she's getting kicked out of school for her behavior. Well, she don't understand what's going on with her seizures. So they finally just realized, like, okay, this is medical.
What has been the cost for you, Brittany, in terms of time and money? I mean, you said you got, you've lost a number of jobs because of this. What has been the financial and the time cost for you so far?
It cost a lot. Like, I'm falling behind in bills. I got to borrow money from people. It's hard. It's a struggle. It's a struggle.
Melissa, when it comes to the increase in lead-associated health impacts, what are teachers able to do at this point? And if you could explain for our listeners also, what are IEPs?
So when it comes to, you know, properly supporting kids in school, they have to do an IEP, an individualized education plan, which says, okay, here's the struggles, here's your challenges, and here's how we're going to work with you around them. And it basically helps kids who are having issues be able to learn in their own way. And this is great. And that's why these exist. These IEPs exist for special education. However, when you don't have enough teachers in the school, when you don't have properly trained teachers, when you don't have enough autism services, supports, things like that in the school system, the teachers are left to basically try to teach special needs children and regular education children, and even regular education children with behavioral issues in a large classroom. You've got one teacher for like 30 some kids, and you're not able to give these kids the individual attention they need. So what happens is it seems like they're acting out, or they're not paying attention, or the kids are just, you know, being quote unquote bad kids. So they get kicked out, when in the all actuality, what's happening is that they don't know how to learn in the way that you're teaching them. But then the teachers have no support because there's no money there. Nobody's even bothering to invest into Flint schools. It's just like they're waiting for them to crumble so they can push all the kids out to, you know, private schools or charter schools if the kids can afford it. And if not, what happens then?
Brittany, when you hear Melissa say that, is that reflective of how you feel as a parent who still has her children in the Flint school system? Do you feel like the schools are not doing enough to address what your children are dealing with right now?
Yes, I do. And I feel like the whole school system is failing my kids right now because they're not getting the proper help that they need or anything. And then I feel like y'all just throw them up in the next grade. No, they really need help.
And what kind of help do you think they need, Brittany? I mean, what kind of help would help you and your children specifically?
Like, I mean, if I got more help with the school system, like them working with my kids, because it's like how the school system is, it's like two teachers in a room. I feel like they just there. They there to get a paycheck. They don't really care if our students fail, pass, or anything.
Melissa, when you hear this, do you see any hope for what the parents in Flint who aren't able to move their kids out of the school district right now to put them in charter schools or get them the additional support that they need, who can't afford to do that, as we're hearing from Brittany right now? Are you hopeful for any change in the future? Is anyone accountable for this?
Right now, no one is accountable. I mean, the ACLU filed the lawsuit and, you know, the school system on the city, county and state level said, oh, yeah, yeah, we'll fix this. We'll work on it. I mean, it has been 5.5 years since the water crisis began. And it's been several years since this was blown up all over the place, gone into the courts. And yet still here we are going into year 6 of our crisis and no one's doing what they need to be doing. So it's still the same thing to where the school systems are kicking the kids out instead of giving them the supports. They are cutting teachers. They are cutting funding. They're cutting after school programs, support programs. They're cutting instead of putting the support in. I don't know where the money's going, but it's not going to support our kids. So the best we can do is what we've had to do since day one. All of the parents and activists got to stand together and yell and scream for help. Be like, hey, our kids are failing. Our whole future is at risk right now. And you guys are doing nothing. And you should have been stepping this up as soon as you heard there was lead in the water, because you know how it affects children. So I don't have hope in people doing the right thing. I have hope in the people themselves standing up and forcing these officials to do the right thing.
Brittany, you're a parent there. You have children who are directly being affected by what's happened with the water in Flint. What do you want to say to officials, whether that's at the school board, the state, federal, or local level? What do you want to say? What do you want to ask them for?
I don't know, like, because it's just so much. It's so much. And, like, I deal with so much on the day-to-day basis. And, I mean, it's just a lot. First of all, they need to get it together, period. It's been 5.5 years, going on 6 years, and nothing haven't been done. It's time for somebody to just step up and do something. Our community failing us. Our school system failing us. The job system failing us. You don't have nobody. You can't look forward to nothing, really. We have nothing.
Brittany Thomas is a parent of school children in Flint, Michigan. And Melissa Mays is a parent social worker and founder of the advocacy group Water You Are Fighting For. Thank you both for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's the show. Thanks so much for being with us today. I hope you get a chance to watch some of the public impeachment hearings tomorrow, and we'll see you on the other side. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.